My general topic over these several days is entitled Christian Response in an Uncertain America. And yesterday I sketched out something of a profile of what I see as an America come unglued, an American society that's filled with a lot of self-doubt and confusion and uncertainty, where the social fabric is becoming unraveled, where the sense of cohesion and identity are no longer something to be taken for granted or something that is obvious. And in this situation, I pointed out that there are two very powerful and very influential temptations. The one is the temptation toward a kind of authoritarianism, where people shore up their institutions and belief systems and sense of identity, and the other is a kind of unqualified relativism and privatism, where people increasingly retreat into themselves. If the world is chaotic out there, and there isn't any clear notion of what America is or where it's going, then perhaps what I can do is to deal with myself and realize my own individual potential and the like. And it is that profile of America that I want to discuss. And so I'd like to move toward that this evening, but I do so as a systematic theologian, and systematic theologians are funny kinds of animals. We always get at things from around Robin Hood's barn. We never start with what's evident and obvious and concrete. We always sort of get high on the mountaintop. Those who have gone climbing up into the hills here will understand. We're the people who like to climb to the peak and get up there and see the broad picture and then gradually move down into the valley and finally end up over there at the dining hall with Holden dinner in front of our plate. And that's sort of how I'm going to be moving now. So now I'm moving up to the mountaintop and getting a broad perspective and sort of sneaking up on this whole topic. And that's why tonight I'd like to have us think a little bit about what I call the human hunger for security. Because I think that has a lot to do with what's going on in our society. And a place to begin there is to spend a little time reflecting about the basic human environment of anxiety. Now that sounds very, very strange, very remote. There aren't too many of you who are feeling anxious right now, at least as far as you're aware. You may be thinking of all kinds of things to eat after tonight's meal in our hunger awareness experience, which is a very important one. So maybe we're thinking of wonderful tossed green salads or something like that, but we don't exactly feel anxious. So what does it mean then that this theologian comes along and talks about this sort of fundamental environment of anxiety? But I'm going to use the term in a very technical way, the way it is used in philosophical and theological circles, and I think it's a very important term and a very helpful one and a very revealing one. It's hard to believe that the primary force that's propelling each one of us every day is the presence of a sense of anxiety. It's true that from time to time we feel troubled or we feel fearful. And sometimes we are a little nervous and we bite our fingernails or we wonder what's going to happen. But we really don't think we're that anxious. I mean, that anxiety is the fundamental driving force in our humanity. That sounds rather odd. And in a way it is, because we assume a very particular notion of anxiety. And I'm going to try and expand that notion now, as it is expanded a lot in theological and philosophical reflection. Anxiety is more fundamental and more pervasive than either distress or fear. Anxiety is, if you will, a sense of being restless. A sense that life is open-ended. The assumption we all have that we have to make it up as we go along. It can be associated with a certain kind of wariness, but it can also be associated with a certain kind of enthusiasm and delight. The simple fact of the matter is that as human beings, we have to make something of ourselves. We have to make something of the day. I mean, you get up here and hold it, and you know, what are you going to do today? Now, there's the schedule out there by the board. Are you going to go hiking? Are you going to take a nap? Now, the point is that you can make some decisions in this matter, can't you? I mean, it's not already programmed for you. There is a certain open-endedness to the agenda. And that's what anxiety, the reality of anxiety, is about. Life is such that we have to make something of ourselves. Now, anxiety, though, is very, very interesting stuff. And perhaps we can get an even better sense of it if we think about what it means to be afraid of the dark. You know, we talk about being afraid of the dark. Now, that's really rather odd. What does it mean to be afraid of the dark? Usually when we think of fear, and we think of it quite rightly, we think of it in terms of some concrete object. We're afraid of particular things. We're small children growing up, and we learn to be fearful of certain things. Or we learn to be cautious about certain things. I mean, we're afraid of poisonous snakes. Or we're afraid of jumping off very high places. Or we learn to be cautious. We learn to be cautious about the use of matches. Or we learn to be cautious about crossing the street. I mean, we sort of build it into ourselves, or our parents do. We have a tendency to just want to dash out between the cars into the street, and our parents train us to look both ways before we cross. So we learn to be cautious in that regard. We are afraid of very particular dangers, and we're cautious about potential dangers. But here we're talking about fear of the dark. What is that all about? Well, fear of the dark is really not fear, nor is it caution. Now, we might exercise caution in the dark. You know, the lights go off. Say the hydro plant gives out up here, no electricity in Holden, and you don't have one of those famous flashlights that are being called to use in Vespers this evening, and you have to move around. You're going to move rather cautiously because you don't know the furniture and the layout around here. So that's caution. Or suppose you were out in safari in Africa and you didn't have a weapon with you, and suddenly you heard the cough of a leopard nearby in the middle of the night. You might feel some fear at that point. So there's caution, there's fear. But what is this business of fear of the dark? See, it's nameless. It's objectless. It has nothing to do with anything concrete, like bumping into furniture or the danger that a leopard might pose when you can't see the leopard and you have no potential defense. What happens there is we now understand what anxiety is. Anxiety really surfaces because the dark in this instance is the symbol of our basic vulnerability. We're somehow vulnerable and exposed, and therefore we feel anxious. So Paul Tillich describes anxiety this way. He says, anxiety is finitude. It's being limited, it's being finite. Anxiety is finitude, experienced as one's own finitude. In other words, it's not just a theoretical idea. You experience your own finitude. You experience your own delimitation in the world. So we can talk about the anxious bride or the anxious bridegroom. Now, what's going on there? Well, part of that nervousness might, in fact, be due to, say, some concern that they might forget their marriage vows or say something silly or not right in front of everyone. It's a kind of self-consciousness. Or they might be nervous about introducing people properly in the reception line. You know. But there's something even more fundamental going on. Perhaps the nervousness that is going on is really an expression of fundamental human anxiety. That is, they're nervous about the marriage itself because although they love this other person and are committing themselves to this other person, they know that the future is totally open-ended, and there's no way you can second guess where things are going out, are going to come out, and now you've connected yourself to this other person and you don't know what you're in for. And that's the anxiety. That's where the anxiety comes in. Anxiety is part and parcel of what it means to be human, because to be human is to somehow be two things at the same time. It's to be a fragile, limited, mortal creature that is simultaneously self-aware, self-directing, inventive, with a certain measure of real freedom. And that's what it means to be anxious. It's that we are free and finite at the same time. And we can never escape either one. And that's anxiety. And that's why anxiety is our constant companion as human beings. That's why we're sort of restless. That's why we always have a sense that we've got to do something with ourselves. And out of that comes all the richness of what it means to be human. All of our responsibility and all of our creativity come out of that fundamental anxiety. Even when we are radically delimited, what's interesting to see is what human beings do with that delimitation. You can see two terminal cancer patients in rooms adjoining one another, and their responses to that terrible, radical sense of delimitation can be itself radically different. Two different kinds of people, same situation. Because we still have the capacity for imagination and creativity and answerability. We are the sum total of the choices we make, the longings we have, the loyalties and values and commitments that are there that make us who and what we are. So that's why in many, many different cultures, human beings are often described as hybrid creatures. Sometimes we're seen as the conjunction of body and soul. People might put it that way. Or some cultures might describe what it means to be human as saying, we're part angel and we're part animal, or something like that. Or we're a part of nature and yet we're a part of something that is a supernature. Many, many different variations, many different ways of describing it. What they're getting at is this whole business that to be human is to be simultaneously free and finite, limited and yet open-ended. And Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher, has passed on to us a wonderful ancient Greek myth. And for those of us who are conditioned by our prejudicial positivistic culture to believe that myths are stories that are not true, listen to this myth and see if this is untrue. The myth goes like this. Once upon a time, Anxiety, the goddess Anxiety, was walking along a riverbank, walking, pacing. See, Anxiety never sat still, always on the move. Anxiety was walking along the riverbank and out of need for something to do, scooped up a chunk of clay by the riverbank and began to sort of punch it and push it and poke it. And next thing you know, she sort of threw herself into this work and began to create a form, a shape. And she created this wonderful form. And she thought, this is really terrific. Look what I have, and note the word, created. And so Anxiety then called upon Zeus, the father of all living things, to come and take a look at this and say, what do you think of this, Zeus? Zeus looked at that and said, this is fantastic. This is a wonderful thing. This thing that you have created deserves to come alive. So Zeus breathed into this object the breath of life, and it became a human being, the first human being. Sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? I mean, little variations there, but sounds somewhat familiar. All right, so then what happened? Then there was a dispute that began to arise between the gods about who had jurisdiction over this creature. And Anxiety says, it belongs to me because I created it. And Zeus says, no, it belongs to me because I gave it the breath of life. And Gaia, the earth, said, no, it belongs to me because you made it out of my very substance. And these three deities argued back and forth as to who had jurisdiction over this creature. Finally, they couldn't decide who had jurisdiction, so they called upon a fourth deity to decide for them. So they called in Cronos. They called in time. And they said, we give up, we hand it all over to you. You make the final decision. So time said, I will make the final decision and the final arbitration. This creature is such that I will decide when it will be the right time, and what belongs to Gaia, the earth, will return to the earth. What belongs to Zeus, the father of all life, will return to Zeus. But so long as I give this creature time, this creature shall be the creature of anxiety. Now, who says that myths aren't true? Now, that's part and parcel of what it means to be human. To belong to the earth, to belong to the sky and life, to belong to time, and to belong to this open-endedness, this restlessness, this uncharted, radical orientation toward possibility, both positive and negative, that we call anxiety. The conjunction of limits and freedom. Now, therefore, it's not surprising that a good part of what it means to be human is also focused on a search for basic security. If, in fact, we are the creatures of anxiety, we want to have some sense of stability and some sense of security. And here the developmental psychologists are really very interesting. Erik Erikson, who really is the major impetus behind developmental psychology in our era, says that the first year of life faces a very important crisis that needs a creative resolution. The infant is in a state of radical dependency, radically dependent on forces outside of itself to even just simply survive. The psychological issue that is present in the first year of life is the issue of fundamental trust. The infant needs to learn to sense fundamental trust. And that's why it's being cradled in its mother's arms or its father's arms is very important. There is a sense of having a place in the world, a sense that somehow the infant senses it matters. It is paid attention to. It is cared about. And Gordon Allport, a psychologist, says that without this fundamental sense of security, the individual will then develop a pathological craving for security and is less able than others to tolerate setbacks later on in life. So we need to have that kind of sense of basic trust that we are cared for. There's something larger than ourselves out there that's supporting us and caring for us and affirming us. And this gives us a sense of basic security. And along with this, we need a basic sense of self-esteem, that we matter and that we're okay, and a sense of personal capability, that we can cope and that we are creative and that we have some measure of power. So Ernest Becker, another psychologist, says that what we need is a sense of solid achievement from testing ourselves against the world and proving that our powers over against that world. So all of this is basic to being human, living in a world that is characterized by anxiety. We have to have this sort of basic security that includes a sense of participation, of being affirmed, of being cared for, of being okay, of mattering, and of having power and capacity to shape life and be effective. ages 2 to 4, say Erikson, there we have to find our own autonomy. There we have to learn how to be independent selves, how to stand on our own 2 feet, and hence that explains the terrible twos. No. All right, Johnny, it's time to go home now. No! I don't want to go! You know, and stamping feet when I was saying, what happened to that nice little cooing baby? You know, his terrible terrible twos and temper tantrums and all that. The kid is experimenting, not always in the best way, but the kid is experimenting, trying to find where his or her autonomy is and how far it reaches. In school years, says Erikson, the major issue there is to develop a sense of personal industry, to be initiative and assertive, to be able to be productive and have an impact. When puberty comes, it's a matter that we have to try and suddenly deal with our own self-awareness as selves. We suddenly have to accept ourselves. And in our mature years, we have to learn to feel productive and effective and learn to contribute to life. In our older years, we have to face our physical decline and the eventuality of our death. Now, none of us pass through this process easily or fully. There's always room for growth, and very often we fail to resolve these major developmental issues that are just built into what it means to be human. And therefore, our lives can be troubled, and there's a need for us to somehow come to grips with that agenda and grow. And for those of you who would like to do some reading in this area, the need to be aware of ourselves, the need to be aware of the dimensions of possibility of growth, personal growth, and accepting responsibility for our own lives, I suggest Scott Peck's The Road Less Traveled. Perhaps a fair number of you are familiar with that book. That might open up some of this material to you. And along the way, what we're doing is we're learning to gain a sense of security. But that security always exists within limits. We can never get beyond the limitation any more than we can escape the freedom. We're finite beings, and finite comes from the Latin word finis, which means a limit or an end or a boundary. We still remain vulnerable. And therefore, there's a kind of interesting tension going on in the business of human development. We need the underpinnings of basic security, and yet that security has to be a realistic one. There's no total security. There's no unassailable fortress. There's no final resting place for us in this world. Our security is always limited, and we can never get beyond those limits. Just think of Jesus, who had a powerful trust in God and who had apparently a very strong sense of himself, and yet said, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. You know, foxes have their holes, birds of the air have their nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. There's a kind of open-endedness, there's a certain vulnerability, there is always risk and delimitation that is involved. You never can find any final resting place in this life. There is no fortress, no matter how powerful it is, that is unassailable. It is always limited, and all of our securities are limited. Now, our problem is that anxiety is difficult to live with. We don't want to live there. Let me live in Peoria instead. I don't want to live in Anxiety, USA. There must be some place on this planet where I don't have to feel this anxiety. That's our problem. And so very often what we're doing is we're scrambling around, many times at subconscious or unconscious levels, trying to get this kind of security in place. You know, I know I'll do it by the book, you know? Let's see, I want the white picket fence and the rose-covered cottage and the 2 kids and the station wagon and the dog, and, you know, I'll do it by the book, and or how to succeed in business without even trying. I'm going to do it by the book, and I'm going to be fine. I'm going to feel secure. I'm going to fit in. I'm going to join the health spa. You know, I'll join the right club, whatever. I mean, I'm going to fit in. I'm going to just be fine. And there's something rather interesting about this. The more we scramble around trying to feel secure, the less secure we feel. That's the interesting thing. Alan Watts calls this the law of reversed effect. He says, and let me quote him here, insecurity is the result of trying to be secure. And contrarywise, salvation and sanity consist in the most radical recognition that we have no way of saving ourselves. And the example he gives is trying to float. You remember trying to float as a kid? You get out there and you try so hard, and what happens? Boom, you know? It's like you have stones in your bottom. You just got pulled right under. It's when you stop trying. It's when you give up and you just let go that you float. That's the way it is. That's how life is put together. Health and maturity consist in learning to live with anxiety. To learning to live with limits and with freedom, not in trying to get it mastered. And that's, from a Christian point of view, that's what it means to be a creature. Now, when you turn to Luther's Small Catechism, I think there's something very interesting that you find in his explanation to the three articles of the Apostles' Creed. Take a look at the first article. I believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. Now, instead of launching off into some elaborate explanation as to how God brought the universe into being, and to enter into some kind of controversy about evolution or creationism or something like that, Martin Luther has a totally different understanding of what it means to say, I acknowledge that God is creator. What does it mean? It means I recognize that I am a creature. I recognize that God has created me and all that exists, and that he gives to me and preserves to me my body and my mind, my soul and all my senses, and all my property and goods, and takes care of me every day, and on he goes, and he says, for which I am in duty bound to thank, praise, serve, and obey him. This is most certainly true. To call God creator is not to argue about Genesis and evolution and Darwin. To call God creator is to say, I'm a creature, and I'm radically dependent on something other than myself, and I have to learn to live in the world that way. Life is not a possession. Life is not my private property. Life is not something bright and clever that I figured out and invented for myself. Although we walk around like that, don't we? Isn't that weird? Life is not a right. We talk about rights a lot in this country. Life isn't a right. Who has the right to life in the first place? When you talk about, I'm not talking about in the sloganeering business of right to life and all that, but in a fundamental sense about the fact that we are alive. Who gave you the right to be alive? I mean, you sat around somewhere in the cosmic scheme of things saying, I demand to be born. Life is radically gift and miracle. Gift and miracle. And there's no way to get around that. And that means we are subject to anxiety our whole life long because life is not our possession. We never had control of it in the beginning, and we won't have control over it at the end, and we really don't have control of it in the middle, even though we like to think we do. And that's what it means to be a creature. It means to be the child of anxiety. Finitude and freedom put together and never being able to escape either one. Now, the human problem is that in this kind of anxious world, we like to cultivate illusions. Our anxiety is not something negative. Our anxiety is neutral. Just like the whole business of being human is neutral. It's what we do with it. Our anxiety impels us toward creativity and toward responsibility and a healthy affirmation of ourselves in the context of our creaturely limits. But it also tempts us to escape its constant pressure and tension and undercutting. We like to get out from underneath anxiety. And so we cultivate illusions, self schemes of self-deception. And Sigmund Freud said that what is characteristic of illusions is that they are derived from human wishes. That's the secret. We have our illusions, we have our deceptions because we want them. See, that was Columbus's problem. Columbus operated according to illusion. He so much wanted to sail around the world and discover the East Indies, what we now call Indonesia, that when he bumped into those islands, he said, aha, here it is, Indonesia, and called it the Indies. And of course, now we call it the West Indies, because now there are two, just like we call Native Americans Indians. I mean, we got it all confused. Why? Because Columbus had this passionate desire and wish to get to the Indies and India, and he bumped into North America instead. That's an illusion, and that's us. We are involved in strategies of illusion and self-deception. And psychoanalysis is very interesting in unearthing the way in which we operate with these coping mechanisms and defensive strategies and frames of reference to keep us from having to deal with life in its anxious character. Now, it's not so bad to have coping mechanisms sometimes. You know, you're in a terrible grief situation. You know, there's been some terrible tragedy in your life. And the psyche kind of sort of hunkers down. It kind of, we don't allow ourselves to see everything and feel everything right away because we couldn't handle it. It's too much. So in a crisis or in terrible pain or trauma, we just kind of minimize what we allow ourselves to see or feel. And then gradually, bit by bit by bit, in a process, we allow ourselves to feel more and more. We feel our grief, or we feel the pain, or we feel the anger, or the resentment, or the guilt, or whatever it is. Okay? But sometimes our coping mechanisms are such that we don't want to deal with any of this negative stuff at all, and we don't want to deal with the whole business of anxiety. But the point is to accept the fact that we are subject to forces beyond our control is very, very central to our health. And a good example of this, I think, is the person of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a very energetic, athletic, bright, ambitious young man with a rising political career and was really very cocky in a way. Then he was struck down with polio. He was struck down by polio. Radical limitation. There you are, FDR. You are a creature. And he had to finally accept that. He had to accept that limitation. But out of that acceptance of his own limitation and his own pain and frustration came a kind of special strength that he didn't have before, and a kind of wisdom, and a kind of empathy and sympathy with people. And there are some who think that FDR could not have given this nation the leadership that we had in the Second World War had he not gone through the crisis of his own polio, and having to accept those kinds of limitations, and to be strong within them, rather than thinking, you know, the world's my private oyster and everything in every way is getting better and better for me. I think maybe that's something of what we sense about John Fitzgerald Kennedy and his assassination. You know, some of a kind of mythos developing in the American psyche about JFK, you know, this sort of golden person. But now, of course, we're beginning to find out all about the scandal and all that sort of thing. But cut down in his prime, and you know, the trauma of that, and the strangeness of that, and how it is this this sort of undoing of a fairy tale. There, too, we find the whole business of having to deal with anxiety, having to deal with delimitation and freedom connected to one another. So very often what happens is, faced with our creaturely limits, we want to get out from underneath them. And this shows up in very odd ways. And I remember one Newsweek, issue of Newsweek, and within that single issue, there were three interesting stories from this point of view. First, it talked about the growing tendency to bring malpractice suits against professionals. No, we don't like it when things don't come out our way. Therefore, you know, the doctor didn't cure me. He's supposed to. Therefore, malpractices. Now what's happening is there's a special breed of lawyer these days. These lawyers defend law firms who are being sued for malpractice and not delivering the goods for the original malpractice suit or whatever it was that was brought in the first place. I mean, we want everything. We don't want defeats. We don't want frustrations. I mean, it's right there. So now there's this new breed of lawyer defending law firms against malpractices. Second story also had to do with malpractice or suits anyway. It talked about local governmental officials resigning from their offices all over the place because the local municipality didn't have the funds to get insurance against being sued. And therefore, they felt they might be personally vulnerable in civil suits. Therefore, they said, I'm not going to be mayor. I'm not going to be the county commissioner. I'm not going to be the water commissioner. I'm resigning. And here are people resigning from public office because they're going to be subject to suit. Why? Because Americans don't accept the fact that, you know, things break down, the garbage doesn't get delivered, or whatever it is. Undelivered. And the third article was written by a professor of philosophy at the University of Alabama who pointed out the American preoccupation with preventive medicine and exercise. He said, this isn't a bad thing. You know, I mean, here we are out in Holden, right? Get out there, hike, get your cardiovascular system working, eat this healthy diet, low on fats, you know, start getting a healthy, you know, intake of food and so forth and so on. We're all for that. So is this professor of philosophy. But he says, what's interesting is the sense that somehow Americans believe if we're out there all jogging and hitting the Scandinavian health spa and we're eating granola every morning and lots of yogurt and stuff, somehow we're going to hold back aging, illness, and death. Well, you know, enjoy yourself on your way to the grave. But, you know, that's where we're all headed. That's the final destination. And the aging process is irreversible. And illnesses do lie there, no matter how many vitamins you take. But the fantasy that we have that somehow we can escape it, that's the interesting point. That's part of this business of illusion. Living in a certain kind of way, living with blinders on, not being radically honest about who we are and where things are at. Or take something else, our drive for perfection in behavior or certainty in our knowledge. You know, the freshman shows up in college and suddenly has the whole cosmos torn apart in little pieces. And then in the sophomore year starts scrambling around trying to say, I've got to get a handle on the truth. You know? Somehow it's got to all fit together. I have to have that certainty. Well, who has it all figured out, you know? And then they discover no one has it all figured out. Oh, who wants to live in a world like that? I mean, someone has to have a handle on the truth. And Plato talks about Socrates saying, no, I don't have a handle on the truth. I just have this little kind of heavenly being, this daimon that sits on my shoulder and tells me when I don't have the truth. You know, that's the best we can do. You don't have it figured out yet, Socrates. You can question that. You can see the phony thinking over here, and you can see how poor an argument that is, and so forth. And so on. You can always learn something new. And so, you know, we hear this, you know, the final end of education is that we suddenly realize how little we do know. And for this, we spend $60,000 to find out we don't know anything? Well, maybe it's an important lesson. Or our drive for perfection, doing the right thing and doing it well. Well, who do we think we are? That somehow we're supposed to do everything and do everything perfectly. I mean, isn't that really rather grandiose when you think about it? Sort of, a Michelangelo and an Einstein and a Thomas Alva Edison and the winner of the Boston Marathon all rolled into one. I mean, is that who each of us is? No, we're limited beings. But somehow we have these fantasies and these wishes that somehow we really can get it all together and have control. And Ernest Becker, another psychoanalyst, says, what it really boils down to in the final analysis is we're all trying to deny death. All strategies trying to deny the fact that we're going to die and that we're mortal, finite beings. And that's our insanity. So, Alan Watts again, let me quote him. If I want to be secure, that is protected from the flux of life, I am wanting to be separate from life. Yet it is this very sense of separateness that makes me feel insecure. See the insanity of it? In wanting to be secure, we cut ourselves off from the wider world. We can't enter into it. We can never really grow. And because we're aware we're cut off and we're isolated and we're not growing, we feel more and more insecure. To protect our life from death means that we live a life that's increasingly dead. So Watts again. The desire for security and the feeling of insecurity are the same thing. To hold your breath, exercise control, right? Hold your breath is to lose your breath. A society based on the quest for security is nothing but a breath retention contest in which everyone is as taut as a drum and purple as a beet. We talk about being uptight. You know, that old phrase from the 60s. Wanting this security. And this insanity, this wanting control, is what traditionally Christians have meant by the term sin. That's what sin is. Sin is not basically failing to be the perfect Eagle Scout. Sin is not immorality or impiety. Sin is the unwillingness to accept the rules of the game of being human. Namely, that we're both free and limited. And we say, I don't want it. Give me one or the other, but not both. Let me hide. Let me just kind of float along in life. Philosophers, the wonderful philosophical phrase for that is called existential drift. Just kind of drift down the stream of things, you know? Don't bother me. Don't get me excited. Don't say I'm responsible. Just let me kind of float. And on the other hand, we say, well, as long as I'm going to have freedom, give it to me full dose. I mean, I want it all. But to be human is to be both finite and free. Now, you see, we have this wonderful golden Cocker Spaniel at home who had a traumatic puppyhood from which we rescued her at the age of 2.5. And she has attached herself to the family in a very neurotic way. And she can't stand it when we go marching off to places like Holden Village and leave her behind. She's, her claws are worn to a nub when we're back, fighting them, and just frantic there, waiting for the rest of the pack to come back and wondering why we've abandoned her and left her back at the den. I mean, that's how our dog mind is operating and thinks that we're abandoning her and we're punishing her. And so in her exasperation and her anxiety and her upset and her anger, she sometimes leaves little surprises for us in the kitchen floor, which upset us greatly. And of course, you know, I'm just tempted to go in and scold her like a good father would to a child, saying, "Now you know that you're not supposed to do this. We've potty trained you," or something like that. Well, it doesn't work with a dog. I mean, you know, it hardly works with a kid. I mean, what the dog needs is reconditioning, and it's pretty hard to do. We can't say, "You irresponsible cocker spaniel." I mean, she's a finite creature, and she does not have that same kind of freedom that human beings do to be responsible. Now, in the ancient Greek world, they said the ultimate powers ruling the universe were not even the gods. It was something more fundamental and more ultimate than that. The fates. Fate ruled everything, even the gods. Now, the fates, they never had an anxiety either, human anxiety, because they controlled everything. They had unlimited freedom. They had no limits. Our cocker spaniel has the limitation, but not the freedom of being a self. The fates have unlimited freedom. They don't have the limitation of being a human self. But we human beings are both. And sin, from a Christian point of view, is our attempt to run out from either or both of these things. We try to gain mastery over life. That's our egoism, our pride, our aggressiveness, our manipulation of other people, our wanting always to be in charge. And as I pointed out, it comes in strange ways. It even comes in our attempt to try and be perfect or to do better. You know, there's nothing like doing better. Isn't that wonderful? Get out there and just do a better job. And our workaholism that's out there is really a form of sin. Martin Luther understood it and called it works righteousness, life under the law. We can't feel good about ourselves until we do everything perfectly and we do it all. But notice the egoism involved in that. Incredible, grandiose egoism. I mean, on the surface it looks, oh, I'm self-critical, I don't feel good about myself, I'm always putting myself down. You know, I never do a good enough job. Yeah, but who the hell do you think you are? That, you know, you're supposed to do all these things. Very unrealistic. Not willing to accept delimitation. Or else then it's the flip side. Søren Kierkegaard said that's the first form of sin, egoism and pride and all the rest of it, is the masculine form of sin. It's not limited to men only. But culturally, it's kind of associated with that kind of masculine psyche. The other is the feminine form of sin. And we Christians are not too good about that. We're very, very strong on masculine sin and condemning it. We're not so strong on feminine sin and condemning it. Feminine sin is this business of existential drift. It's not willing to accept responsibility, not willing to accept freedom. It's wanting to be dependent and go along and low profile, don't look to me, I'm only human, and so forth and so on. And that is sin also, because that's the denial of our own creaturely freedom. It's interesting, when Orson Welles' Mercury Theater presented that incredible radio drama about Martians invading the United States on October 30th, you know, Halloween, 1938, what they estimate, 1 million listeners in the United States panicked. They did not have enough sense of independent judgment, even though it was announced that it was a radio program. They listened to it and thought it was real, and they didn't have the sense to even exercise independent judgment. Instead, they were overwhelmed by feelings of helplessness and dependency. So this is the insanity of our being human. An insanity that the Christian community has called sin. And to have the power of sin broken means to accept both our freedom, our responsibility, and our creativity, and our limits at the same time. And in this respect, I think there's incredible insight and wisdom and health in the first step of the 12-step program of AA and Al-Anon and other self-help recovery groups. In the first step says, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, or we were powerless over compulsive eating, we were powerless over other people, whatever it is. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. What's going on there? We admitted our limits. We admitted we couldn't exercise control. We admitted that we were not in having mastery over everything. But we admitted it. We took responsibility for it. We admitted it. See? This healthy conjunction of freedom and limits together. And as a Christian theologian, I look at that recovery program, and I think it's very remarkable and very coherent with the gospel. And 2 weeks from now, I may spend some time talking about some of that. But notice how these two things come together. Freedom and finitude. That, I think, is a necessary element for us to think about as we look at a society come unglued where people are hungering for security. But the point is, are we hungering for it in such a way that we want security by denying our freedom or by denying our limits? I'm sorry that the bell is rung and our time is up. I wish we had more time for discussion. Maybe after Vespers, if some of you want to seek me out and share your questions or reactions with me, I'd be very happy to have you do so. And for those of you who would like, I have some suggested readings here for this session and for the next session, which will be America as a Social Security System. And if you care to pick them up, you may.